loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Justice Department official Bruce Orr gave testimony and answered questions for 8 hours behind closed doors yesterday in a hearing held by the House Judiciary and House Oversight and Government Reform Committees. What does Orr's role in the investigation into alleged Russian collusion say about the nature of the entire Mueller investigation? Next, the governor of Puerto Rico commissioned a full study on the death toll from last year's Hurricane Maria, and the results have been released. Up from the original estimate of 64 fatalities, this week's report put the death toll at 2,975, making Maria one of the deadliest hurricanes ever. Then, with rumors swirling about President Trump potentially firing Attorney General Jeff Sessions, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham appeared to throw his hat in the ring. Meanwhile, this morning, President Trump announced that White House counsel Don McGahn will be leaving in the fall. And then, important primaries were held across the country last night. In Florida, progressive Democratic candidate Andrew Gillum won the gubernatorial primary against frontrunner and former congressperson Gwen Graham. And his competitor, conservative Ron DeSantis, has been supported by Donald Trump. In Arizona, establishment favorite Martha McSally defeated two far-right challengers. And finally, teachers and faculty voted last night to approve a strike if negotiations with Seattle Public Schools don't produce a tentative contract by the start of the school year on Tuesday. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the strange case, maybe it's getting stranger, of Justice Department official Bruce Orr. Bruce Orr gave testimony and answered questions for 8 hours behind closed doors yesterday in a hearing held by the House Judiciary and House Oversight and Government Reform Committees. What does Orr's role in the investigation into alleged Russian collusion say about the nature of the entire Mueller investigation and perhaps the entire story? We're joined from New York City by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rall.com. That's R-A-L-L.com. Ted Rall, welcome back.
Thank you.
Anyway, Bruce Orr, Justice Department official, still working. That makes Donald Trump very unhappy. He did have a significant role, it appears, and more and more has come out in the probe initiated by the Justice Department with Christopher Steele and the Steele dossier and maybe the overall Trump or the Mueller-Russia probe altogether. Anyway, what was your what's your takeaway?
Well, it's strange and it's convoluted. So I think this is one of those stories that if we dig down will definitely be worth pursuing and paying attention to as revelatory about the way that the FISA court works or perhaps doesn't particularly work. But I think this is a story that's going to be largely missed by the vast majority of Americans. In short, there is, of course, the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act, which created a special court, which is staffed by federal judges who basically do this on the side as a freelance gig. And they receive what is called a FISA warrant or an application for a FISA warrant from various intelligence agencies, including but not limited to the FBI and the NSA and so on. This first came to the nation's attention due to the Edward Snowden revelations. And also, I mean, the news broke during the Bush years when FISA first came out that it was kind of a rubber stamp court. That pretty much the FBI or any other federal agency, 99% of the time, they go to one of these judges, one of these FISA courts, and they get whatever warrant they want to listen to whoever they want. It's not a process that is transparent, and it's not a process that has anyone arguing against a warrant. There's no privacy or civil liberties advocates who are there. So pretty much hey, we'd like a warrant, and the judge almost always says yes. There's been studies that have shown that. So now what happened with Mr. Orr is that he went to a FISA court to get a warrant related to the Russiagate investigation. And apparently he relied on what has become known as the Steele dossier. Now, the Steele dossier, for those who followed the 2016 election closely, was essentially a grab bag of what they call oppo research. In other words, opposition research against Donald Trump, paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign. And basically, this happens a lot in high-level political campaigns, even in a lot of local, even a lot of state races, where one candidate wants to find out as much verifiable and possible dirt as possible on their opponent. The Steele dossier is not an official document. It was put together by a former intelligence officer who basically did this as part of his private investigatory business. And there's no telling whether any of the information in the Steele dossier is real or not. The Steele dossier has never been released to the press, so we haven't seen it. But apparently, the Steele dossier was used in order to obtain a FISA warrant. And that's pretty interesting because supposedly the FISA court is rigorous and follows very strict procedures in order to try to figure out whether a warrant should be granted. The idea that it would even be deemed admissible, something that was essentially a gossip file, the kind of thing that the National Enquirer would keep in their files. That's interesting.
And Bruce Orr from the Department of Justice was the liaison with Christopher Steele, the British foreign intelligence agent, who was paid by Hillary Clinton's team to collect opposition research. And Steele did that probably by talking to Russian or former Russian intelligence agents who gave him uncorroborated, unvetted information. They got paid by Steele. Steele got paid by Fusion GPS. And it turns out Bruce Orr's wife, he's the liaison from the Department of Justice to Steele, and Steele is hired by Fusion GPS and the Hillary Clinton campaign. His wife was also employed by Fusion GPS. So it appears that there's a major conflict of interest. And Orr was also meeting before and after the election, and after the FBI had terminated its relationship with Christopher Steele. Now you have Donald Trump's tweet from earlier today, quote, "How the hell is Bruce Orr still employed at the Justice Department? Disgraceful witch hunt." And then another one, "How the hell is Bruce Orr still employed at the Justice Department? Disgraceful witch hunt." Okay, well, not shocking. These are Donald Trump's tweets from August 29th. But anyway, put some of that into perspective, if you would.
You know, it's a strange world when I find myself agreeing with Donald Trump, but this is one of those times. People have been fired from the Justice Department for far less, and it is weird. There's clearly a conflict of interest here, and the Democrats and frankly the Mueller team seems to be doing as much as they possibly can to try to confirm Donald Trump's allegation that this is politically motivated witch hunt carried out by partisan Democrats who can't get over the fact that Hillary Clinton lost. It looks bad.
Yeah, the Republicans are saying Bruce Orr went rogue, acted as a conduit between Fusion GPS. Again, his wife worked there. They were employing Christopher Steele, who did the opposition research Steele dossier. And one of the reasons they're making the point is that Orr continued to meet with Steele, apparently, after the end of October, when the FBI terminated their relationship with Christopher Steele. And they did that because Christopher Steele was releasing information and documents, and some of the information came from him, but it appeared to come from a third party, to Mother Jones and other media right before the November 2016 election, which would have obviously, if they were using the unvetted, uncorroborated testimony of the Steele dossier, put Donald Trump in a bad light.
That's it. Yeah, that's the size of it. Yeah, and the thing is, it's almost like they're committing suicide here with this investigation. It's like they didn't want to do it by the book, or they just wanted to bend the rules. And if any serious allegations were to come out of the Mueller investigation, they couldn't possibly be taken 100% seriously with these kinds of shenanigans going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. Committee investigators did not find evidence that Orr worked directly with individuals at the Justice Department, Congressman Issa told reporters. "We have found that he was working back and forth as a conduit for the FBI. Now, Andrew McCabe, who was also involved in the investigation of Hillary Clinton and whose wife was also receiving or did receive a large amount of money when she was running for political office in Virginia from Terry McAuliffe, Hillary Clinton's best friend. Andrew McCabe was fired right before he was retired. Peter Stroke, who everybody is now giving GoFundMe donations, $500,000+. Peter Stroke, another senior FBI official, was walked out of the agency. But Bruce Orr is still working, but it would seem to me under these circumstances that might not be for too much longer.
No, it shouldn't be. I don't see how it can be. Given what happened with McCabe, I don't see how Orr is much longer for this particular career path.
You know, and Ted Rawl is our guest. It's very strange. You could organize on so many different issues against Donald Trump. You could organize about his immigration policy, his misogynist positions, the fact that he's trying to make sure that all of our air and water is filled with additional pollutants because it's profitable for corporate barons in those industries that are friends of his, because he sort of redistributed wealth from the poor to the rich through the tax cuts. All of these issues that could be the focus of the Democrats' opposition to Donald Trump, and yet they stick with and are defending guys like Orr, who are clearly conflicted, and clearly biased, and clearly working with opposition research and the Hillary Clinton campaign and Fusion GPS to do something that they wanted to have done, which was to take out an insurance policy because they didn't want Donald Trump to be president. I mean, it seems so obvious, and yet the Democrats keep, you know, throwing into the same ring. 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, yeah, they look like idiots here. It's hard to even discern what they're really trying to what they're after here. I mean, after all, you know, impeachment as a constitutional factor was really put in to get rid of people who had bad temperament and might have been mentally unsound. Donald Trump credibly could be accused of that, and why not just go start with that? If he's the least presidential president we've ever had. And obviously all the policy stuff would be great to organize around. It's almost like they don't want to win this, or they just don't know what they're doing.
Okay, we're out of time. That was Ted Rawl. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. He joined us from New York City. You can check out his work at rawl.com. That's RALL.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou and joined in studio by Brian Becker. Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rosello commissioned a full study on the death toll from last year's Hurricane Maria, and the results have been released, up from the original estimate of 64 deaths to the George Washington University's report estimate on August 9th of 1,427. And now this week's report puts the death toll at 2,975, making Maria one of the deadliest hurricanes ever. We're joined by Dr. Adriana Garrigo-Lopez, Department Chair and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Kalamazoo College. Thank you for joining.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a shockingly high number. I mean, a huge, tragic number of deaths. Why the discrepancy? I mean, we were told 64, and now it seems like maybe even 3,000 people died in Hurricane Maria.
Yes, it is indeed a tragedy, and huge numbers of people have died and have suffered the terrible consequences of the systemic fracture produced by Maria, but facilitated by the austerity regime, the undemocratic austerity regime that has led to social and economic decay in Puerto Rico, further economic decay. And the discrepancy is related precisely to those structural fractures that lead to inefficient use of public resources, that lead to marginalized communities being abandoned or basically left out from processes of counting the dead, of you know, treating the wounded or the ill, of providing basic social services to people. And so the causes for discrepancy in numbers are many. Some of them have to do with methodology, with different studies. You'll recall that we had a different number that was actually much higher. 4,645 was the number that a Harvard team of scientists, researchers arrived at as a likely average between a higher number, that a number that was higher still, that was closer to 8,000, and a lower number. As we discussed, I think before, we may never have a completely accurate final count of the dead, in part also because the consequences of the hurricane are ongoing. And those vulnerabilities that this particular study found, they found that during the entire study period, which went all the way until February of this year. So the consequences of Maria, the structural consequences that led to those higher death numbers than usual in Puerto Rico, had not ended. They had not abated by the time that the study period was concluded. So that tells you that those conditions are ongoing, and that even now, almost a year after Maria, the consequences of the collapse of especially the public health care system in Puerto Rico are still being felt, and that people, especially the most vulnerable among Puerto Ricans, are feeling those effects very strongly still.
Right, because if somebody, you might not have been killed, or somebody might not have been killed in, the hurricane itself, but let's say, you have a chronic medical condition and you're stranded as a consequence of what happened in the hurricane, and you can't get your medication, and someone could pass away very easily, and many, many hundreds of people probably did die that way. So the ongoing, I'm so glad you brought about the ongoing nature of this and its connection to what's going on politically and economically in Puerto Rico, because, this type of catastrophe doesn't happen in every country in the Caribbean, right? So Cuba, for instance, is close by. It deals with, the same hurricane season that Puerto Rico does, but very few people die in Cuba. The austerity regime, bring that out a little bit more. What specifically do you mean by the austerity regime that's been imposed on Puerto Rico?
Yeah, indeed, you're right to point out the example of Cuba, although Cuba did not get hit as directly as Puerto Rico did by Maria. But indeed, the consequences of Maria were felt much more strongly in Puerto Rico because of the systematic dismantling of the public health care sector, of the education sector, which provides not only shelter during storms, but also social cohesion, of the labor market, the mass migration or out-migration from Puerto Rico that has been taking place, and that was only intensified by Maria. The whole structuring of public policy around the payment of the debt, of external debt, which has produced a social misery in Puerto Rico, those were the conditions that made possible the catastrophe that was Maria. So the different numbers that we have reflect different ways of looking at that. At that crisis and at its consequences. Even people who made it to the hospitals, you talk about people didn't have access to hospitals, they didn't have access to care. The terrifying thing is that even people who did have access to hospitals died in huge numbers because the hospitals didn't have electricity, because the hospitals didn't have insulin, they didn't have medications that they needed. They couldn't give patients oxygen. They couldn't give patients dialysis. They couldn't deal with the most basic sort of functions of a hospital, of a community hospital. So even being able to access those structures was not necessarily a guarantee that one would survive what would in other circumstances be a very minor health event. And we also have, by the way, an unaccounted for epidemic of leptospirosis, which another research team has showed that the numbers there are alarmingly high and have never really been accounted for. And, that's the thing that really infuriates me, and I think a lot of other people. There's no accounting. There's no public accounting for this tragedy. There's this study that was commissioned by the government. The government has acknowledged that the number of deaths was very large. even though when President Trump was there, they were quick to, you know, to minimize the number and said, oh, it was 16 people. It was 16, they said, when Trump was there, right? So even though they have acknowledged, though, that the number is much higher than that, we've never had a public mourning or an event of significance that recognizes with the seriousness that is required the suffering and the loss of so many people and so many families that were, you know, grieved by the loss of loved ones throughout Puerto Rico, but especially in the most marginalized communities. And that's the other thing that's really interesting about this new study, is that it shows that the people who were most affected by Maria were the most structurally, precarious in Puerto Rico. And what does that mean? That means women, that means people of color, Black people in Puerto Rico, that means queer people, that means trans people, that means people living on the streets, people with health conditions or special needs, like children with autism, for example. All of those kinds of marginal communities or spaces of precarity were the ones that were most directly affected by Maria. So even though I think all Puerto Ricans suffered this great tragedy in one way or another, the effects are not felt by everyone the same, right? And that's another, I think, important piece that this new study has brought to bear.
What effect do you think Puerto Rico's status as a colony of the United States plays in all of this, and this disrespect or maybe even just this disinterest by U.S. authorities in counting the dead, in really taking a full and accurate accounting of the tragedy and addressing it? I mean, is that rooted ultimately in Puerto Rico's colonial status?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no other way to see it. You know, I mean, that's exactly what it is. And this is a situation in which colonialism has never ended in Puerto Rico. It's only been intensified, diversified, neoliberalized, changed in various ways, but it continues to be the driving political and economic factor in the entire situation of Puerto Rico, including the health situation, the education, the question of the labor market, and the shipping laws that affected Puerto Rico so severely after the hurricane. Even, you know, the inability to receive help from Venezuela, for example, who sent a ship, and the offer from Cuba. You talked about Cuba. We received an offer from Cuba to send doctors, and the U.S., of course, rejected it. So even the ability to receive help offered by other countries is affected or limited or negated by U.S. imperial control. And, you know, what's very painful, I think, for a lot of us or for Puerto Ricans or for observers of Puerto Rico, what's very difficult to understand is that Puerto Ricans themselves or ourselves have sometimes assumed those, internalized those colonial mentalities or those ways of looking at ourselves or looking at our people. And right now, the flag in Puerto Rico flies half-mast for John McCain, but not for the thousands of Puerto Ricans that died after Maria. Those people have never been acknowledged by the government.
We have just a little bit under a minute left. We're getting into this year's hurricane season now. How are people in Puerto Rico bracing themselves for what might come?
Well, people are coping. You know, the situation has been a great teacher. I just came back from Puerto Rico and I visited a lot of people and was amazed and impressed and honored by the kinds of resilience and the work that people have put in, and the kinds of cultural work that is going into the, you know, helping people recover emotionally, psychologically from this great tragedy. Musicians, artists of all sorts are involved in that project. Educators, all kinds of community activists doing gardening or agriculture or art, you know, all kinds of different things. And, you know, feminists, anti-racist activists, labor activists, there's so much energy, there's so much movement, but it's very precarious. You know, it's under this continual sign of insufficiency, and the insufficiency of all sorts. But I think the primary insufficiency is an insufficiency in democracy and self-determination.
We're all out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. We were joined by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She is the department chair and associate professor of anthropology at Kalamazoo College. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou and joined in studio by Brian Becker. With rumors swirling about President Trump potentially firing Attorney General Jeff Sessions, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham appeared to throw his hat in the ring. Meanwhile, this morning, President Trump announced that White House counsel Don McGahn will be leaving in the fall. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and a columnist for Counterpunch. You can check out his work at thiscan'tbehappening.net. Welcome back, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Jeff Sessions and, you know, the all the tensions swirling between him and Donald Trump and now maybe Lindsey Graham. I mean, this is a pretty odd situation to have a president and his attorney general in pretty much open conflict with each other.
Yeah. It's been that way for a while. I mean, you know, the big deal, of course, is his recusal of himself from considering anything to do with the so-called Russia investigation. That seems to have broadened considerably since it started.
Yeah, it's kind of odd because Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump, I mean, they're ideologically right. They're both, you know, far right wingers. They're anti-immigrant. I mean, it you would think that they would get along very well now that they had won the election. You know, Jeff Sessions being one of Trump's earliest backers on the campaign trail, but not so much.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, on all the issues that relate to the Attorney General's office, their immigration and all manner of other issues, they're birds of a feather. So, you know, it's hard to see much light between them except on the issue of Mueller. And I think there it's not so much that Sessions would disagree as that, you know, he's potentially caught up in it. And also, you know, just because people he met, you know, during the campaign. And then on top of that, you know, I think that he has at least a scintilla of self-respect and doesn't want to go down in history as a, you know, a guy who, you know, just let down the Attorney General's office and, you know, covered up for Trump on, you know, these myriad issues that are rising about his corruption.
And so now that Lindsey Graham said in an interview yesterday, you know, the relationship between Trump and Jeff Sessions is beyond repair. The president's lost confidence in him. This is a dysfunctional relationship. We need a better one is one of the comments that Graham made to NBC's Today Show. The comment was that at least up until this point, among the Republican Party and Republican politicians, is that there would actually be a political disaster if Donald Trump replaced Jeff Sessions with anybody, because it would just, I mean, it would be sort of like a repeat of the mistake of firing James Comey, not because James Comey was some wonderful guy, but in terms of political optics and political consequences. Why do you think Lindsey Graham is stepping in now? I mean, is it just personal ambition?
I don't know. I mean, I it's hard for me to even see that he's angling for the AG's spot, because he's also saying that that any appointee to replace Sessions has to stand behind Mueller. So that doesn't sound like a winning argument for getting appointed by Trump.
Yeah, right. And it also sort of exposes something about the Mueller investigation, because even though these indictments have nothing to do with, you know, collusion between the Donald Trump 2016 presidential campaign and the Russian government, it is actually a bipartisan affair in certain respects, in the sense that it's sort of the establishment, right, which is called, you know, the deep state sometimes in the right wing media. I think it just should be called the state. Lindsey Graham, other people in that sort of wing of the Republican Party, I mean, they're actually not opposed to Mueller himself or the Mueller investigation, because it does kind of keep the Trump campaign within a pretty narrow geopolitical framework. But let's move on to Don McGahn. When news broke that Don McGahn had been talking with the Mueller team, I mean, very extensively, I think it might have been for 30 hours cumulatively, I mean, that was a real blow to Donald Trump. And now we find out just maybe a couple weeks later that he's going to be leaving the White House in the fall. Trump made it seem like it was not a firing. He tweeted, you know, completely normal, relatively friendly things about it and about Don McGahn. But do you buy it? I mean, do you think that this was, in fact, a firing of Don McGahn?
Well, he said he was going to leave.
Right.
So it's hard to say who decided first. It sounds like one of those things, you can't fire me, I quit. I don't know which way it would be. But clearly the fact that he spent 30 hours talking with Mueller's people is not a good thing for Trump.
Yeah, Trump's really in trouble there. And the granting of immunity to the Trump Organization CFO, too. I mean, that was sort of a 1-2 punch.
I mean, my sense about this whole thing, Walter, is that, you know, the Russiagate thing, which never really caught on with the American people, except for, you know, your sort of mainstream liberal Democrats in, you know, among the voter base who, you know, would just want to get rid of Trump so bad that they're buying into the claims made by the very intelligence agencies that liberals usually say lie all the time. You know, just in terms of your general average American independent voter, you know, and so on, it's never really caught fire. Nobody sees Russia as a threat or an enemy anymore. And I think that the whole investigation, you know, it was started out as that because, you know, there were forces, like you mentioned, in the Democratic Party who wanted to use that to go after Trump, but it didn't work. But it got this investigation going. And as these investigations are wont, as we know in the past, they tend to move with the course of the testimony that they pull in. And so what we're seeing now is that the thrust of the investigation is moving much, much more towards Trump's personal corruption. And there, I think that they have a gold mine. So just speaking as a New Yorker who covered Trump, you know, as a municipal reporter years and years ago, the guy is like mob connected. He's just really bad news on a corruption level. His whole business model is corrupt. So, you know, there's just a endless vein of corruption to tap into digging into it. And that's where Mueller seems to be headed.
Yeah. And do you think Trump's inner circle knows that, or maybe just the high level cabinet officials, regardless of their closeness to Trump? I mean, do you think that sort of the administration is going to begin to fracture a little bit more? I mean, we have this conflict with Jeff Sessions. Don McGahn is leaving.
I think that there is people who work for Trump don't do it because they love him. They don't do it because they believe in him. They do it for opportunistic reasons to make money and be close to power. And he has there's nobody who's loyal to Donald Trump. And that's true throughout his career. You know, we've got a lawyer who said he would take a bullet for Trump, who's not taking a bullet for Trump. There's no loyalty for that guy. He has no loyalty for his staff. Never has, and it's a mutual relationship. So, you know, when the dirt starts to come out, it's going to be the classic example of all the rats leaving the ship. So he can't count on people like Nixon could to erase tapes for him and things like that out of loyalty. There's not going to be any loyalty in the Trump administration.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. He's an investigative reporter and a columnist for Counterpunch. You can check out his work, his writings at thiscan'tbehappening.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Important primaries were held across the country last night. In Florida, progressive Democratic candidate Andrew Gillum won the gubernatorial primary against frontrunner and former Congressperson Gwen Graham. And his competition, conservative Ron DeSantis, has been supported by Donald Trump. And in Arizona, establishment favorite Martha McSally defeated two far-right challengers. We're joined from Washington by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation, whose live stream can be seen every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. And we're joined from Sarasota, Florida by Juliana Moshayev. She's a member of the board of directors of the Peace Education and Action Center. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So, Jackie, let's start with you. There's a big upset on the Democratic side in Florida, also a pretty interesting race in Arizona, among others. What are your big takeaways?
The big takeaway for me has been what we've been saying almost every week, that grassroots work, just on the ground, canvassing and knocking on doors and talking to people about policy, is what is going to win for the Democrats. And unfortunately, it's not quote unquote establishment Democrats who are doing this. It is the Democrats who represent the more progressive wing of the party. And Gillum's win is another example of that being true. I mean, he wasn't polling anywhere near being competitive in the weeks leading up to this race. So the fact that he won and beat a long-term established favorite and a household name in Florida was hope that sent shockwaves through the Democratic establishment there and nationally too.
Juliana, talk about the other side of that race, Ron DeSantis. I mean, he made like a pretty shockingly racist comment today, and he's of course presented himself as the Trumpist in the race. What's DeSantis all about?
I mean, DeSantis has just latched onto Trumpism as like the foundation of his whole campaign. And I think that's why he was so successful in Florida. I think that the Republican Party is still quite loyal to Trump. And of course, the racist comment is going to go, there's some media hype about it temporarily, but it's just going to go unnoticed because the Republican right is so outwardly racist at this point. But yeah, DeSantis had this profoundly absurd ad where he was indoctrinating his children into Trumpism and like building a wall with his 4-year-old. And, it's disgusting. And so that's basically the basis of his campaign.
Jackie, this sets up, a pretty stark contrast, right? Andrew Gillum versus Ron DeSantis. But of course, there's this whole debate going on. Well, can the Democratic Party really, is it possible for this sort of insurgent progressive wind to assert leadership, or when it does get into office, perhaps the forces that the nature of these types of institutions really has a moderating effect on people. It pulls people in a more conservative direction. What do you think about Gillum? What do you think about his record? I mean, he was a mayor. He was an executive on a local level. What's sort of the next step as this race goes into the general?
Well, the next step for Gillum is definitely to stay on message, the message that won him this primary, because again, this is just like, for me, the Georgia race, right, where people in Florida are really going to have to decide what they want to represent them, what type of politics they want to represent them. And as we've already seen, we see what the Trump Republicans are coming with, and we can't act as if we can keep appealing to the better nature of people who would vote for someone who would make a campaign ad with his 4-year-old teaching them how to build a wall. There's no better nature for those people. So it has to be policy. That's what Gillum has to campaign on. He has to stick to that. And he has to make it clear that these policies will benefit everyone. And I think this xenophobia and racism is going to definitely hurt DeSantis in the midterms because of the demographics changes in Florida. So it's going to be a nasty race. I'm not expecting anything polite, but I think the Democrats need to learn that they need to stop playing, stop going high every time they go low. This is politics, and these are people's lives, and they have to get down in the dirt and fight.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're joined from Washington by Jacqueline Lookman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. And we're joined from Sarasota, Florida by Juliana Mushayev. She's a member of the board of directors of the Peace Education and Action Center. Juliana, what are the big issues in Florida right now? What's on the mind of people who will be voting, or maybe people who will not be voting? How are people going to be making their decision?
I mean, the biggest issues on the long term are economic. So you have a lack of job opportunities, a lack of affordable housing, you know, expensive education. Public schools in Florida are awful. And then, of course, on the short term, we have this red tide, and I live on the West Coast, and it's, you know, now been declared a state of emergency, and it's not a natural phenomenon. It's because of deregulation of the sugar plantations and the runoff, and it's been hurting the local economy. So those are the kind of the things that are floating around in people's minds. And I think that Andrew Gillum's success has been predicated on his focus on economic issues like raising the minimum wage and focusing on raising teachers' salaries to $50,000 starting. That said, I think that people are kind of overestimating how progressive he is. There are aspects of his campaign that are lacking, in my opinion, but I think we're just so jaded by Rick Scott and Trump that someone like Andrew Gillum coming along is such a breath of fresh air, even for someone like me who expects more from people that are representing us.
Let's turn to Arizona now. I mean, there is a very interesting primary there on the for the Senate, right? So Martha McSally ended up winning, but she had two far right challengers, including Joe Arpaio, who needed to get a pardon from Donald Trump because of you know, a criminal conviction stemming from his police department's, I mean, extreme brutal policies and racial profiling. Jackie, what did you think about the election in Arizona?
It's just a mess. I mean, the fact that, and I know people are saying, oh, you know, thank God Joe Arpaio lost, but he did get 20% of the vote. He got 75,000 votes. And the fact that 75,000 people in Arizona thought that this man would is worthy of voting for should not be something that people ignore. But again, we're looking at Martha McSally as someone who we would consider as an establishment Republican. But in order for her to win this primary against Kelly Ward, she had to go farther right than she initially was, because she was not as anti-immigration as she had to be in this campaign. She really had to play up her past as a fighter pilot, and nobody wins. Nobody really wins, I think, in these kinds of races where the moderate Republicans, who aren't really that moderate, have to go either even farther right. And like Juliana said, the Democrats, who are supposed to be progressive, aren't as progressive as they really should be, because their opponents are so far off the cliff of right that anything better than anything left of that is better.
Yeah, Juliana, it's an interesting trend, right? Because even if the far right doesn't win, even if the far right only gets a 20% of the vote like Joe Arpaio did in Arizona, they still kind of have this ability, you know, if the quote unquote mainstream politicians go along with it, which they are, you know, which they tend to do, to control the narrative, to control the issues that people are talking about and how they're talking about it. So their influence, the influence of the far right, can be really outsized in that way, can't it?
Yeah, for sure. We saw it with Trump, and we've seen it for the last few decades. I mean, the Democratic Party has been moving further and further to the right, and the Republican Party has become this extremist, racist party that's backed up by the, you know, white supremacists and white nationalists. And then someone like Andrew Gillum comes along and says, well, I want to, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Well, that's amazing. And that's actually a win for the people, because we had the fight for 15 for so long, and now we have a governor saying $15 an hour. But if you really think about it, to afford to live in Florida, you need to be making about $20 to $25 an hour. $15 an hour is still insufficient, but we've been so deprived of economic justice and just so pushed to the right that $15 an hour is something for us to celebrate. And I mean, that's just going to keep happening unless we keep on the a real progressive platform, keep pushing what the people really need rather than what concessions can be thrown to us.
Yeah. And what's additionally disappointing for me, even for the Democratic candidates, even for their historic wins from a great grassroots on the ground strategy, none of them have been openly anti. That's been very disappointing for me across the board.
That's an important point. We're all out of time, unfortunately. We've been joined from Washington by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. And we're joined from Sarasota, Florida by Juliana Musheyev. She is a member of the board of directors of the Peace Education and Action Center. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Teachers and faculty voted last night to approve a strike if negotiations with the Seattle Public Schools did not produce or does not produce a tentative contract by the start of the school year. This Tuesday, we talk about this new development in the wave of teacher activism sweeping the country. We're joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. She is an educator and the editor of liberationnews.org. Welcome back, Jane.
Thank you. Good to be on the show.
So what's this strike or potential strike all about? What brought teachers and faculty to the point that they would take this strike authorization vote?
Well, as exciting and significant as a potential strike in the Seattle public schools is, and Seattle, of course, is the largest district in the state, it's really just one piece of a larger statewide struggle that's going on that dates back to a 2012 state Supreme Court case, the McCleary decision. And McCleary decision, McCleary's are families who sued the state for inadequate funding of public education. And the Supreme Court agreed with the McCleary's and said the state was inadequately funding public education and told the state to rectify this. And when the legislature failed to come up with a solution, a funding solution, the state Supreme Court held the state in contempt of court, fining it $100,000 a day. This went on for years. So last year in the budget, the state set aside $1 billion for education, specifically for teacher salaries, and then added another $1 billion just now. So there's now a $2 billion pot intended to fund teacher raises statewide, although there's a formula that's directing more of the money towards large districts, which some teachers in small districts are unhappy about. And so there are currently strikes going on in some of the southwestern districts. And other districts have recently settled. Some have settled with large salary increases or are currently in negotiations. So the Seattle strike is within, or the potential strike is within that context of the statewide struggle around the McCleary funding, where this is after years and years of no raises, teachers are facing the possibility of getting a significant and substantial, meaningful raise to rectify their severely underpaid conditions. In addition, the teachers in Seattle are also have added to their demands that of making ethnic studies mandatory for all students in the district.
We're talking with Jane Cutter. She is an educator in Seattle and the editor of liberationnews.org about the strike authorization vote taken by Seattle teachers and faculty and the broader struggle around education in Washington state. Jane, I mean, when you say underpaid, you know, even though teachers may make more money than other segments of the working class, I mean, the teachers have to fund a lot of their classroom supplies, right? I mean, a lot of the basic things that you would think would be provided by your employer, teachers end up paying for that out of pocket. I mean, it's a job, it's a profession unlike any other.
That is absolutely correct. Teachers are spending often not only hundreds, but sometimes thousands of dollars on basic classroom supplies. Even things as simple as pencils and paper, let alone, you know, the decorations, the extra reading books, things that make a classroom special. Teachers are spending their own money on this. Many teachers in districts with a high percentage of children living in poverty will keep food in their classroom to give to children who haven't had breakfast. Or who are still hungry even after eating the school-supplied meals, just to, you know, help the child be able to learn, to be able to just give them something, a protein bar or a cereal bar. And so these are things that teachers are paying for out of their pocket. And that's now with the new Trump tax regime that we have, teachers aren't even able to claim this as a deduction on their taxes, which previously teachers were able to claim a certain amount of this expenditure, at least on their taxes, or if they itemized.
Let's talk about, well, what you just brought up in your last response, this demand that from the Seattle teachers that ethnic studies becomes mandatory. I think that's very important because whenever, you know, whenever anywhere there's a teacher strike or the possibility of the teacher strike, the authorities, in this case, you know, the local government, they have a big opportunity to do like a divide and conquer campaign where they present the teachers as self-centered, as greedy. And the fact that they're striking means that, you know, your kid isn't getting an education or, you know, you might have to make, you know, expensive daycare arrangements or something like that. But, you know, adding this demand, adding something that recognizes that, you know, this is a struggle for quality education for everybody. You know, in this case, we want ethnic studies, so classes that can help students overcome and struggle against racism. Those types of things are really important, right?
Yes, absolutely. So the Seattle teachers were on strike just a few years ago, and that time around, two of their demands, in addition, of course, to conditions that would also, demands that would clearly benefit the teachers, they also, one of the things they struck over was making sure that kids had adequate recess. With the current round of educational reform, children have been, in a very developmentally inappropriate way, recess has been cut back, so that kids can spend more time, you know, practicing filling out bubble tests. So that was one of the things they fought for then, along with better processes for discipline to help avoid the racial disparities in school discipline. So now the teachers in Seattle are very committed to fighting against racism. They've, in the past couple of years, had several district-wide days where teachers all wore Black Lives Matter t-shirts to school and had days of internal education within the school around racism. So this is just a continuation, really, of that struggle that they've been engaged in to engage the students and the larger community in understanding, in anti-racist education and in uplifting the cultures and the histories of students from oppressed nationalities.
What's the overall political climate like in Seattle with regards to labor? I mean, Seattle has sort of a reputation as being a liberal, progressive city. You know, like pretty much all big cities, it's governed by the Democratic Party. You know, what do other sectors of the labor movement think about this? What does the community, the population at large, think about teachers and educations and unions? Do you think that there'll be a substantial amount of public support if the teachers do end up going on strike?
I think so, yes. For the most part, certainly the last strike was a good example, which again was only a few years ago. The families, parents, the community came out very much in support of the teachers, who showed a lot of, you know, creativity and energy in their strike, as teachers are wont to do, coming up with, you know, like clever videos and songs and things like that, and a lot of solidarity coming from other parts of the labor movement. So I would anticipate that for the most part, the families and the community will be supportive of the teachers, and because these are, after all, are the teachers who teach their children and who are taking a risk to go out paid a decent wage so they can afford to live and continue to be teachers. A lot of people are leaving the profession because they simply cannot afford to live. But what teachers are being paid certainly does not allow them to be able to afford to live in Seattle, where housing prices are off the charts. So we're now looking at teachers, you know, having to hold second jobs, teachers commuting in from very far distances from where they can afford to live. And all of this, of course, impacts on the ability of teachers to be fully present for the children when they are teaching. If you're holding down a second job or you're spending hours in the car commuting, that's time you're not spending teaching or prepping for teaching. So I think parents understand that teachers want to be able to be the best teachers possible for the children. And these situations the lack of funding, all of these things that they're fighting for are things that prevent teachers from being fully effective. So I think in general, there's a lot of support for the teachers in the community. Of course, some elements will try to paint the teachers in a bad light, but there's always some haters out there.
Right, that happens in any kind of strike. And of course, this, to put it in the broader national context, I mean, this comes after strikes in West Virginia, a major strike in Arizona, in Oklahoma, in Kentucky, I believe there were major mass mobilizations of teachers. All across the country, I mean, there's this wave of teacher activism, and they've been winning. I mean, they've been securing major raises, major changes and improvements to the education system. And now it seems possible that Seattle will join that wave. We were joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. She's an educator and the editor of liberationnews.org. That's all the time we have. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We're out of here.
Loud and clear. We'll be right back.